Welcome to the Work Design Podcast. Listen to the world's greatest leaders share their stories and secrets on how they designed and built the best places to work. We'll shine a light on the challenges and breakthroughs of designing org charts, optimizing teams, and building jobs that people love. This is for modern leaders who are building the best teams at scale. Let's make work work better.
Welcome. Today, our guest is Giles Anderton from Cantor and Ball. Cantor and Ball is a product delivery and digital disruption,
digital transformation
agency. Thank you very much, Damien. We also have with me today Damien Bramanis, co-founder at Functionally.
G'day, Tim.
We have the privilege of bringing this podcast to you today, talking about all things work design, which is job design, team design, and org design. Giles, fantastic to have you here on the podcast today. Tell us a little bit about your experience from probably the first time you had to lead a team or ended up in management through your experience over the years developing that skill.
Thanks, Tim and Damien. It's great to be here. I suppose I accidentally got involved in management after being a software engineer for a long time and product manager. But I mean, I was working in Sydney, 20 something years ago, and I was in an engineering team of 15 people, and the five senior people in the team all quit on the same day, and then the business started looking towards me because of the background I'd had in the music industry and promoting gigs, I'd always been focused on, you know, caring about what people using the systems that we were building were and that sort of stuff. So I'd naturally thought about the business a bit more than perhaps the other developers in the team. And that's really when I started getting promoted into more sort of technical leadership and then, you know, development management type roles. And, you know, through that over the years, I got into more and more, I guess, running large programs of work and managing teams of developers and doing all sorts of consulting work around the globe. I moved to the UK in 2005 almost immediately was sort of managing consultants, doing consulting work on, you know, software delivery implementation projects, and eventually ended up around 2009 running the Guardian's digital delivery function for a couple of years. And then I set up Cantor and Ball in 2011. And through Cantor and Ball, I've done a lot of interim director level roles, managing all sorts of teams. These days I'm pretty bought into the self-organizing multidisciplinary team approach and, you know, getting those people together. And I'm fascinated by how do you get smart, creative people to work together well, you know, without it being a nightmare.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, this is definitely the place to come and hang out if that's what you're into. A couple of quick questions. So break it down for us. What's the what kind of size teams did you end up having to coordinate lead at the peak in terms of headcount, contractor and employee, all inclusive?
I think the largest team I've been involved in directly sort of managing is about 300-ish. That was kind of as a interim handholding responsibility at the Government Digital Service in the UK. Otherwise there's been a few teams of 150-ish along the way. I mean, the Guardian team was probably the first role that was more than sort of 30-40 people, and that was around the 100 mark. Predominantly developers and designers and product managers type thing.
Do you think things change? So you said that there were a few teams much bigger than 30 or 40 people. Do you think things change once you get to a scale of tens or hundreds of people?
Yeah. So I think a startup starts with the idea that we're going to have a flat structure and there's going to be no management and all that stuff. And I think that starts to break around 12 people. Mm-hmm. I think there's somewhere in that 12 to 20 thing, you need to just put in a little bit of process. So the new people that are turning up actually know how to find out and discover the information that the three people that started the thing do, and all those things. And I think there's a around the 30 mark where things start to break a bit as well.
So what breaks at that point?
I think really you've now just, by the time you've got to 30, you've been going sufficiently long usually, where, formal, the people that have come on, there are people on board that weren't there at the start, and the people, sometimes all the people that were there at the start with some aspects. And bear in mind, I've always been involved with the technology and product delivery side of these things. So I'm really speaking from that realm. And so, early on, a lot of the time, practices, I suppose DevOps is helping a lot with this because you're automating a lot of these technical things now. But, 10, 20 years ago, you would have a situation where the people that started, they'd cut corners, because it's a small business and you don't have much time. And, for all good reasons, things just don't happen. So by the time that you come to 30, you're probably well beyond product market fit. You're probably at needing to stabilize the product. The tech stack is probably creaking, or there's bits of it that's a bit spaghetti-like, and some of it's not documented. And now you've got staffing, you've got new people there helping professionalize it or make it better in some way. And you also don't have any of the historical information because a lot of it's walked out the door and it wasn't documented it hasn't sort of seeped through the brain of the organization.
So it's sort of three waves all crashing at the same time. There's the technology mistakes of the past that come crashing with the people changes as the organization grows. And then also this, you don't have all of the information that you need. Yep. So everything comes crashing down at the same time.
Totally. And I think that really starts to kick in at 30 people. Mm-hmm. I think once you get past that, once you get, into the sort of more up around the 60, 70, 80 mark, maybe a little bit more depending on the organization, you start getting to the point where you need to have, you've got a lot more middle management. And I think once you're starting to get middle management, i.e. where there are people whose job it is to manage other managers, and they're not the executive, by that point you're starting to get really quite complicated communication channels, and usually they're not as well looked after as they could be, shall we say.
Well, let's dig into some of that. We often, when we're talking to CEOs out in the field, they talk about that process feeling like it's breaking, or they're spinning plates and or on fire, and no matter what they do, fires just keep lighting everywhere around them, and all they want to do is become more strategic as the organization gets bigger. But what they're really doing is getting more and more into the trenches of that firefighting that goes on when you've got these layers of middle management. Tell us about through the lineage of your experiences in the UK, particularly where you're leading much bigger teams. What are some of the crazy things that you saw going on that you felt were related to the design of the organization or a team, as opposed to, people problems that other people may have looked at and gone, oh, that person's just nuts. We were actually, I think we've got a design issue there.
I know of a place that's, that they have purpose-built tech that was specifically built with multiple applications for that organization in place. And the people organization has the way that's been, the responsibility for that ownership of that organizationally has been shifted two or three times, to the point now where no one actually understands that tech exists, despite the fact that they spent millions building it. And the original people that know about that just aren't there anymore. And I look at that as total, that's the worst case of waste to me. You've actually gone to the effort of building this thing that could be useful in a lot of contexts. And this is an organization that really could use the obvious revenue that can come from deploying that in multiple areas that it hasn't. I see things like that. And I think that's happened because as they've changed who it reports to, they've seen it as a very specific oh, that's for this vertical, not for that one, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. It's a bit heartbreaking too to the people who would have been there in the beginning to see, to know that the thing that they were so involved with is now, like, their work goes to waste. It's not just a shame for the company, but it also is a shame for the individuals. It's demotivating.
I think it's a thing that you know, 10 years ago when we would meet and have beer and talk about that stuff, it would be painful.
Yeah.
And now it's morphed into more of, it's sort of funny.
Yeah.
But, it's either way, it's sort of, I don't know. I think we're very good at constructing big organisations of people all trying to be busy and wanting to be in charge of stuff instead of working, you know, more cohesively and collaboratively in teams. And so this is the sort of outcome. And I think the org design is a big part of that. I don't feel like I've really answered your question very well, to be honest.
Yeah, no. So really, we're really interested in the pain that happens in the organisation. So what pain it is that you feel, that other people in your team feel, when things start to stretch and become misaligned.
And look, I think wastage, which is what you're talking about, it's a huge part of that, where things are going on in the organisation and people don't even know. That might be talk of a system, but I'm sure there's situations where people are working on stuff, spending time, effort and energy, and no one realises that they're doing that. And that can come to a pretty painful end. Often once it's discovered and people are rectifying it on the fly.
I think, yeah, absolutely. I mean, when you work in, particularly I think the thing that the startup has that has the ability to be nimble, it's not constrained by this stuff, but, you know, a bigger organization, I mean, once you get past 500 employees and then, you know, bigger than that, I mean, you start getting into fiefdoms and, you know, you're well past Dunbar limits.
Yeah.
So how do how many organisations are there? I mean, look at this town here. I mean, how many organisations in this town that are employing thousands of people have basically multiple teams focused on the same problem and those teams aren't even talking to each other?
So tell us about Dunbar limits, because that's the first time it's come up on the podcast. I'm really interested to hear your thoughts on that.
So Dunbar, that's going to test me now, but the Dunbar limit's about, I think it's 130-odd. Dunbar is a psychologist from the 60s, and he wrote a paper, which I can't remember the name of, but it's all really about how many relationships you can effectively hold on to as a human being, and actually have a relationship, and not necessarily a friendship, but I think where that relates to the workplace and designing working organizations is groups of people collaborate and function and perform better when everyone knows each other in some way.
Yeah.
And beyond that, you're now beyond the capacity that an individual has to even be able to have a, you know, place a name to a face necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
So you as soon as you go over Dunbar limits, you go beyond. What it means is that you're adding pressure to everyone in the team to do more work with people that they don't necessarily have a relationship with.
Yeah.
And so how that actually manifests through those things is different. So how do you deal with that? I mean, there are some people that advocate, well, as soon as you get to 120 people, you have a completely new company. Others are, you know, you don't have departments bigger than 100.
And what's your personal opinion? What do you think happens once you stretch beyond the number of people you can actually realistically know? What should you do at an organization once it grows? What have you done in the past?
I don't really think it matters that much whether they work in the same organization or not, but I think they should be working in... You should keep your working groups much below Dunbar limits.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, so like I think a program of work, you know, if you talk about the sort of right at the coalface, a sort of classic multidisciplinary delivery team, you want to keep that sort of in the 7 to 11 type group of people, because they can, and if you can get them focused on something and then they're enabled to do what they need to do, that's how you'll have the most efficient success there, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So doing that is complicated. So then you have to break down, then you've got, there's only so much work that many people can actually do. So a bigger program, so a bigger piece of technology, whether it's a portfolio or a program or however you're organizing, you know, you're running the work,
mm-hmm.
I think you need to map those teams to, you know, keep them within, something that 7 to 10 people can actually hold in their heads at the same time.
Yeah.
There's an amazing book that's just been released, Team Topologies, by Matthew Skelton and Manuel Paz. But that talks all about cognitive load, you know, and keeping within cognitive load limits of the team. So don't put a team on a piece of, you know, they're focused on software. Don't put them onto a piece of something that they can't, that team can't have in their head conceptually.
Yeah, like, so keep the work small, and keep the work and the team small enough that they can actually hold it in their head, the people and the work.
Yeah, and I think that relates to the individual, the team, and then the program. And I think at the program or portfolio, when that comes down to the organization, there's how big those things can be built together.
Yeah.
So I just think Dunbar limits is one of the chunks.
Yeah.
And, you know, much like I think putting 5 people on a project will often be much more successful than putting 100 people on the same project.
Yeah.
You know, for many reasons, keeping a entire department to under 80 is more sensible than making it 1,000.
So that's one of the things that we've seen. So you said that you see that organizations break once they hit around 30 people. We've seen that's maybe the point where you can't keep it in your head anymore. Where if it was a 10-person organization, you know all of the work and you know what everyone does. But at a 50-person organization, that's impossible. So that perhaps that point is where you can't hold things in your head any longer.
Yeah, so I think that's the cognitive load limit of that sort of thing, is the cognitive load limit of a team working on a thing. I don't think that's okay for a whole department to be doing 20 different things at once in groups of 10.
Mm-hmm.
Or sorry, 8 things in groups of 10. And then you have the management of that. There is an administrative overhead, obviously. And then how are you documenting and how are you communicating that and keeping everyone with a shared level of understanding?
Yeah.
And I think it's the shared understanding thing is the point for me. Shared understanding and continuous improvement. You know,
how do you do that? How do you get people to a shared understanding?
I think context and actual people is what matters. You know, is there a startup here that's not using Slack and all? You know, everyone's working in coffee shops. That works for people that are in that context.
Mm-hmm.
More traditional organizations need, you know, there needs to be a weekly, you know, email from the CEO. Or from my point of view, I think it's really about how people in the organization want to work together and what communication they respond to.
Yeah.
And then I think it's starting with whatever that is, and then it's spending time, you know, across the organization focused on continuous improvement so you can actually make those things, you know, improve them and make them more efficient.
Yeah.
I think one of the challenges with email is that you just get bombarded with email to, you know, I'm sure all of us who worked through the 90s and 2000s have got email overload. But, you know, the same thing is happening with Slack, where, you know, you get added to a Slack channel. There's way, you know, everyone's, there's no policy, around it. And the problem isn't really Slack or email. The problem is the policies around how to use those things.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where I think understanding the context and what the actual problem is. You know, if a department is doing, or if a company is doing 3 different things, how connected are those 3 things? And in which case, how much does it matter that everyone's across what everyone's doing? You know, if I'm a software engineer working on, you know, making sure the website doesn't blow up, what level of information do I need to know about the nuts and bolts of what the marketing team is doing for the entire company, or the sales team and all that? Now, I have an interest and I want to understand.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, but then I think different companies and different contexts and different people care about these things differently. And in fact, even inside the same company, different people feel differently about this.
And it's where when you're at the company offsite, everyone can focus because you don't have all the alarms going and off, all the emails coming in and all of the things happening around you. It's a lot more conducive to work.
It's amazing the things that get put in place to take time out from the bombardment and waste of communication and trying to achieve a shared understanding where a lot of these organizational frustrations are.
Frank Lama's Functional 5.
So question 1, what do you need to be functional?
a strategy and support, or a vision, really. I don't really need a strategy. I can come up with that, but yeah.
A vision.
Yeah, I want, you need a vision and you need the support around you to do it. You know, I don't think you can do anything of note on your own.
Yeah.
Awesome. Question two. In work design, who inspires you or who would you like to hear from on the podcast in the future?
Oh, so many people. I've literally just finished reading that Team Topologies book, so it's in my head, and I think it's a step change. I think it's a lot of ideas that have been talked about in the DevOps community for a period now, but I think that's a really great book. And so Matthew Skelton and Manuel Paz, I like that stuff. It's very tech focused, organizationally. I suppose, you know, I'd love to hear from more behavioral psychologists. Mm. I mean, the Thinking Fast and Slow book's coming to my mind. I can't remember the guy's name. But yeah,
we'll fact check that.
That's Daniel someone. I'm not sure if he's still alive.
Easy people to get in contact with. If you've got contacts out there with any of those authors, we'd be more than happy to interview them on the podcast.
Correct. Question three. What's your favorite shortcut or hack that you've done with work design?
Walking meetings.
Nice one. Yeah, great. That's a good call. And if you could make it all over again, if you had to do what you've done again, what would you choose to tackle or break first as it relates to work design and org structure?
Almost certainly whatever departmental silos exist.
Yeah, break the silos. And question five, actually, which is the most valuable resource asset. I'm just going to get you to call out that book again on Team Topology.
Yeah, it's just really fresh in my mind. Team Topologies, Matthew Skelton, and
great.
Yeah,
we'll go search for that and pop the links in the information about the podcast so people can find that. And you also mentioned Dunbar Limits as well, which has a bunch of great information online. We'll go and make sure we find some links to that for people. Any final questions before we say goodbye, Damien?
Any last little hints or any oddball tips that you've come across?
I think the main thing for anyone involved in looking at org design is to try your best to remove your immediate desire to instantly provide solutions. Mm. You know, I think when you consider starting a new directorship or new management job and you think in the 30, 60, 90 day thing, I think you should be very, very careful about spending the first 30 to 60 days learning rather than trying to make changes.
Great, great advice. Thank you so much, Giles. It's been great having you here today. There's been some really, really good tips and key takeaways there. So thank you again and hope to speak to you soon.
Yeah, thanks very much.
Awesome. Great having you on the show.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks for joining Tim and Damien, co-founders of Functionally, on their quest to make work work better. If this episode has given you value, please share this with another leader and don't forget to subscribe. Subscribe now to make sure you're among the first to listen to the next episode of the Work Design Podcast. For more about the latest in global work design trends, head to functionally.com and sign up for our monthly work design publication.